All right, so everybody take their seat and quiet down. We'll start the meeting for the Public Safety Policy and Finance. And I don't know if we've got a quorum or not. Since this is informational, it doesn't make a lot of difference. We can vote on minutes later. Members, today we're going to have a presentation, the sex offender program. And before I introduce our two testifiers, I just want to preface the meeting with some comments. For years, we've been trying to figure out what to do with sex offenders in our state. And today is probably be an emotionally charged meeting, and there'll be some hot, pointed questions. The media has been calling already quite a bit and is covering the meeting today. But the quandary that we're facing, and everybody knows, is what to do with sex offenders and whether they should be released, confined forever, treatment. And naturally, the article that came out recently in the papers about the two that were going to can be considered to be released or are in the process of release caused so much concern and backlash that it's almost like sending it back to square one of deciding, you know, what to do. So we are, even though the fiscal account isn't in this committee, it's actually with Health and Human Services, we can have a great effect on their overall policy and what it's going to be for the future. And you'll find out here today that it's a burgeoning cost and population to take care of these people, but it's also a huge concern looking at the articles recently, trying to find a panel that is going to make one of the most important decisions they could possibly be making in their lives and whether to release one of these individuals. So we've got a real job ahead of us to sort through this, and I don't even know if we'll get a handle on it this year, but we're going to listen to the testifiers today. It's a friend of mine, Dennis Benson, that I've known for a while and charged the sex offender program, and is Jeannie Hebert. There we go. And if you want to go ahead, sir, and state your name and title and begin.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dennis Benson. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We're located, as most of you know, under Department of Human Services, and we are the program that's charged with managing civilly committed sex offenders. By and large, these folks have completed their criminal sentences and have returned to court and have now been civilly committed to a program at either Moose Lake or St. Peter. And there is a statute that drives the civil commitment process, 253B. They are either committed as a sexually dangerous person or a sexual psychopathic personality. Today we have about 605 of these individuals. We'll get into some details. What we would like to do this morning is give you an overview of the program, where we're at in the program, what our goals and objectives are, how we intersect with the Department of Corrections and their treatment programs for sex offenders, and answer any questions that you might have about this process. Again, there are 605 individuals that are located at either Moose Lake or St. Peter today. We also have another 51 that are located over in the Department of Corrections and in the prison system that are dual commits in our program. We operate two sites with 722 full-time equivalents. Our annual operating budget is $67.4 million for fiscal year 11. We have some more budget information a little bit later on in the presentation. As I mentioned, we have two sites. Moose Lake houses a little over 400, I believe, and St. Peter is just under a couple of hundred. Moose Lake is primary treatment, front end of treatment. It's admissions and reception. And St. Peter is the end stage of treatment, where those individuals that have completed phase one, phase two, would be transferred down to St. Peter. For the most part, they live inside of a secure perimeter, but we need to understand that they all do not. We have seven now that are living outside of the secure perimeter at St. Peter. We do monitor them with ankle bracelets, GPS, but they do go on escorted visits into the community. They go to outpatient treatment into the community. They are at the very end stage of treatment, and we refer to that as CPS, or Community Preparation Service. Civil commitment, as most of us know, is we have lots of partners. We do not decide who comes into our program, nor do we decide when it's time for somebody to be released from our program. We like the phrase, courts in, courts out. That's an honest description of how they come in and how they get out. We may have some influence in terms of recommendations around when they're ready for placement at CPS or even provisional discharge, but we do not make those decisions, us, we meaning the program. That is a court-driven decision. It's driven by the statute. Communities get involved. Certainly about 90-95% of the people in our program come from the Department of Referrals from the Department of Corrections. Counties are certainly involved in terms of the petition for commitment, and then ultimately the finding would be a district court judge. So lots of partners in terms of how they get in, and then of course the release process or provisional discharge process is simply the patient petitioning for provisional discharge. There's a special review board that hears that petition, and they make a recommendation to the Supreme Court appeal panel, and that's sort of the gist of how that process works. And a three-judge Supreme Court appeal panel ultimately decides whether or not someone will be provisionally discharged or not. That would be then placement in the community, and the final step would be full discharge, which of course we haven't had in many, many years in this program. We also need to understand that we are not the only civil commitment program in Minnesota. We also, as you know, civilly commit mentally ill and dangerous, and MRs, mentally retarded. We don't do that. We are a separate program from that process, but we are located under that section in the statute. Janine is going to talk a little bit about that civil commitment process to give you a better understanding of how that works, again, from when they come in to when they might be provisionally discharged.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Janine Hebert. I'm the Executive Clinical Director of MSOP, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the process of coming in and getting out, as well as the treatment program, before I hand it over to Dan Storkamp. As Dennis talked about, the first part of the civil commitment process for SDP, sexually dangerous person, and SPP, sexual psychopathic personality, mirrors the other commitments in Minnesota. So in the case of MSOP potential clients, the Department of Corrections reviews sex offenders prior to release from the department to make recommendations of those who will be referred on to the counties. The county of commitment is the county that makes determination of pursuing that petition for commitment and ultimately committing. Individuals who are referred for commitment, not yet committed, have an option to be housed in corrections for up to 210 days or to come to MSOP. Our Moose Lake facility is our admissions facility, and we have a wing of clients who are in that legal process at some point. So they are referred for commitment. The courts consider the commitment, and if they meet the criteria, they are then officially initially committed. Because we fall under 253B, 60 days later, they take a look at the case again to see if that person still meets the criteria for commitment, and if they do, they are then finally committed. That 60-day review period mirrors what happens for MI and MIND, and it makes sense for someone who may be psychotic that they may initially meet the criteria for commitment and in 60 days they take medication or could be stabilized, but they don't need it for final commitment. For the cases of our folks, if you're a rapist at initial commitment, you're probably going to be a rapist 60 days later. We don't have treatment that will be effective in 60 days to make that type of change. But this mirrors, again, 253B. That's what happens when they put us under the same commitment statute as the other types of commitment. If someone is committed to MSOP, we have to provide treatment to those who want to pursue it. We have about an 80% participation rate in treatment, which is really quite high compared to other civil commitment programs. There are 19 other civil commitment programs in the country, and the Fed system also has a civil commitment program. We have a three-phase treatment process, which I'll talk about later. And as Dennis mentioned, individuals, regardless of their type of commitment, can petition every six months for decrease in custody, provisional discharge, or full discharge. So in our case, our clients, in order to move outside of that secured perimeter down in St. Peter, they petition to that three-person special review board who makes recommendations to the Supreme Court of Appeals panel, and that three-judge panel makes a decision to place them in community preparation services, where they continue to do treatment with us. They're still on the St. Peter campus. Then those individuals petition again through that same process for provisional discharge and full discharge. As Dennis mentioned, we currently have 7 clients who are in the community preparation service, and we don't have anyone on provisional discharge or full discharge. Before I talk about treatment, I just want to ground ourselves a little bit in the phenomenon of sexual abuse. If you imagine that top horizontal bar is all sexual abuse occurrences, depending on the research that you read, between 80 and 90% of sexual abuse cases are never reported. So we can only talk about the ones that we know. In order for them to come to the light of the court system, a victim needs to come forward. Some of those are reported. Of those that are reported, they're investigated. Not all those investigated are substantiated. And not all that are substantiated are charged. And, of course, not all charged sex offenders are actually convicted. So when we think about convicted sex offenders, it's the bottom of that triangle. It's a small percentage of folks who we know are doing the harm in the community of sexual abuse occurrences. Minnesota has been really quite successful compared to other states in managing sex offenders. We're not perfect, but we do manage the vast majority of our registered sex offenders in the community. So at a snapshot at any given time, about 80% of registered sex offenders are living in the community in Minnesota. Now, they may have been placed directly on probation, or they may have gone to prison and are released from prison, but about 80% are living in the community. About 15%, again, at just a snapshot, are incarcerated in prison, and MSOP has about 2.5% to 3% of the registered sex offenders. So when we think about sex offenders in general, and we're only going to talk about that small percentage, I just want to remind folks that it's not all the sex offenders in Minnesota. Of course, to earn your way into MSOP, you have to go through an awful lot of steps. So we have the highest concentration of pathology and toxicity, and in courts proven those most likely to reoffend. So the clients that we do have are the furthest end of that spectrum of sex offenders. Sex offender is a legal term. As a psychologist, it doesn't help me very much in providing a treatment plan. It just identifies the law that was broken and this line that somebody stepped over. So in Minnesota, we have criminal sexual conduct, first, second, third, fourth, fifth degree. But that doesn't tell me the clinical picture. So MSOP gets everybody who comes to us from the courts, but they are very different in planning treatment. So we know from research that sexual deviance is the greatest predictor of recidivism. So the vast majority of our clients are very high on that spectrum of sexual deviance. We could have someone who's very high on sexual deviance, very low on antisociality. They may not have any other types of offenses in their background. They may have no mental health issues, and they may be of average intelligence. Client B could be very high on sexual deviance, could be very high on antisociality, could be presenting with other violent offenses as well as property and person offenses. They could have mental health issues and be on medication, and they could be low functioning. So when we design our treatment program, we have to be prepared to treat everybody that the court sent us. And these are just some of the continuums that we do treatment planning on, but I wanted to just give you a snapshot that not all clients in MSOP look alike. They do by the court standard, but psychologically they're very different. As I mentioned, we have a three-phase treatment program. The first phase of treatment, these are clients who have probably served several years in prison. And by the time they come to us, there's what I say is a lot of concrete has been poured beneath their, above their issues. So it takes a while to get to what we need to treat. It's not uncommon for other civil commitment programs, clients to range between 7 and 9 years of treatment. So when we think about MSOP as being pretty slow to turn out clients, I would remind folks that less than 10% of all civil commits in the country have been released. And there's several programs in this country that haven't released anybody yet. So it's a more a statement of the population of who we're treating, that these are very difficult clients to treat, and it takes a very long time to make the changes necessary to decrease their pathology to the point that public safety can be met. In phase one of treatment, we start to initiate therapeutic relationships with these clients, and we begin with behavioral control. Can you follow the rules? Can you do what we ask you to do? We call it an external locus of control. Once we know that they can follow rules, then we move into phase two, which is the insight portion of treatment. We start to take a look at the underlying issues in their sexual offending behavior. We use polygraphs to substantiate client self-reports. In order to move from phase one to phase two, clients take what's called a maintenance polygraph. So we think they're following rules, they say they're following rules, but we use a polygraph to make sure that in fact they are following the rules. In phase two, we do polygraphs again for behavioral concerns. We also do polygraphs regarding their full sexual histories. So again, it's not just what the courts have found them guilty of, but I'm interested in what they have done over their lifetime with regard to their sexual offending behavior. We also take psychological testing in phase two, and we do penile plethysmographs to measure sexual deviance. If anyone asks questions about that, I can take that later. Once you're finished phase two, you move on to phase three of treatment, which is really the maintenance period. They've gotten all the information from treatment. The question is, can you apply it? And are you demonstrating meaningful change? It's important in MSOP that we take as many looks from as many angles with these clients as possible. So while we do treatment groups as predominantly the venue for treatment, most anyone can behave themselves for a couple of hours in a group. I want to know if they can follow the rules when they're at work, when they're in school, when they're on the basketball court, when they're walking down the hall. So when we do quarterly evaluations of where they're at in treatment, we take input from all staff. So it's not just the therapy staff that say where someone is at in treatment. These are individuals who've obviously demonstrated violent histories and what they're capable of. So when we move someone forward in treatment, we want to be as confident that they truly have made the changes. This is a difference for the treatment programs that are in prison. Prison is predominantly about containment. So they go to treatment. It's almost like during the day, and then they come back, and they're locked up as offenders. That's not a criticism of the DOC. It's just that it's the design of the program. We have the luxury of doing treatment 24/7 that cannot occur like it can in a prison. As Dennis mentioned, we have two sites. Moose Lake has the mission to take folks coming in the door. We also have specialty units up at Moose Lake. The original building has 25-bed units. They're much smaller treatment units. And then we also have another building with 400 beds. In the main building, those 25-bed units, we have one unit for individuals with severe persistent mental illness, SPMI. We have one unit of young men who have come up through the juvenile system. These are folks who are very institutionalized and are probably pretty vulnerable to the rest of our population if we intermingle them with the adult offenders. We have one unit of the assisted living. These are individuals who are aging. And this is the unit of folks who need some additional supports. They're not quite nursing home level of care, but they're working their way towards it. We have a behavioral unit for clients who cannot maintain appropriate behavior. It's a temporary placement before they go back to treatment. And then we have our conventional units. Out in the 400-bed program, we have the individuals who choose to not participate in treatment. We have conventional programming, and then we have that unit I spoke about, which is holds and admissions. Those are clients still in the court process. MSOP has a collaborative program with the Department of Corrections, which is something we're really excited about. And this 50-bed program is located in the Moose Lake Prison, which is just down the road from where MSOP is in Moose Lake. This 50-bed program is staffed by MSOP clinicians, and it's embedded in the prison. And the program originally is designed for individuals coming into corrections who look as though they're going to be referred for civil commitment upon their termination of their time. Rather than going through the conventional sex offender program, they come to this program, and they mirror this treatment program that they would get if they were civilly committed. And the hope is that these clients, if they are civilly committed, then start treatment further down the road so that's more efficient, or ideally that when they are referred for civil commitment that they're already treated, and so they divert civil commitment completely. Dennis will talk a little bit more about the details of this program. Here's a snapshot. Or not. There we go. Here's the look at this program. Keep in mind that it was started in 2001, which is before this MSOP administration came, and it's gone through several changes. It's a hybrid program, and there's no other program like it in the country. So it's evolving as we go with the collaboration with corrections. But Dennis, you want to talk a second?
Well, basically, one of the concerns that we all have is the population growth in the Minnesota sex offender program. Is there a way that we can manage this population a little bit differently? And about a decade ago, when I was in corrections at that time, for those of you that don't know, I spent 34 years in corrections, and I've been over here 3 years. But we came up with this idea that maybe we ought to pre-treat some of these people that really had the civil commitment dot on their forehead. Let's get them into treatment and see if we can manage them, manage their treatment needs prior to completing their prison sentence. So we are treating these people obviously at a much cheaper rate in corrections, hoping to divert some of them from civil commitment before they get to us. Now, obviously, if you look at the chart, it doesn't work for everybody. But there are about 49 that haven't thus far been civilly committed. We think that the number not committed versus the number civilly committed is going to continue to grow. In fact, we're sure that in recent years is where we really have got our best results. We didn't have a clinical supervisor in that program until 2008. So we have some confidence in this program. We think the results thus far are promising. It is a joint venture between the DOC and DHS, but I think it's in keeping with all of our wishes that if there is a cheaper but still responsible way we can manage this group of offenders without compromising public safety, let's take a look at that. The other thing I would tell you is this is a 50-bed program. There are about 200 or 300 people on the waiting list for this program. So one consideration might be to increase this program if we continue to see positive results. We report on this program every year in our annual report. You'll see the same chart and graph in our annual report that I think just came out. And I think it's worthy of your time and would ask that you take a peek at it.
Director, what confidence level can you give me that DOC and MSOP should be making these decisions about what about the people are a little worried about? Is it DOC now that would make the recommendation whether they went in the end or forward for review? So what about the people that are worried that maybe the way that they control this prison population is referring less people for review or giving less, you know, the same people that are involved in the beginning decision and end decision, now that it's a collaborative decision, the two are working together of not fudging the facts, but, you know, controlling your own costs by sending less people down the road to your partners.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's a fair question. I would defer to DOC to talk. The Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit in DOC is the unit that reviews sex offender cases, and they have in their policies an outline in quite detail that decides who they refer and who they don't refer. But if we have any sense of a pattern, if we take a look at this, only 5 of 195 cases were not forwarded to the county by the Department of Corrections. So the vast majority did go on through that process, and I think that the Department of Corrections forwards more than not and allows that for the court process to make a decision with regard to that. So I don't know that I can predict the future, but 190 of those cases were referred and either pursued or not by the counties.
And then I suppose the reverse question would be the other worry that sending too many down the road and building a kingdom in the end. So I'm just wondering about the level of decision making, who is in control of it, and the referrals back and forth. So something in.
Yeah, again, Mr. Chair and members, I would say that the Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit is really quite impressive. It's the level of detail that they combine actuarial scores on assessments of offenders. They combine the file reviews. They look at whether they've done treatment or not. So it's a very thorough review of the cases. All level three offenders are referred automatically. And then the Commissioner of Corrections reserves the right to pick other cases that may not meet that level for referral. So I would invite Corrections to come and talk in more detail about how they make those decisions for referral.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Haber, this the difference then between the two, between the DOC and the MSOP, what are they getting in regards to treatment in the MSOP system that they would not be getting in the DOC treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, with regard to the MSOP DOC site or with regard to MSOP main building?
Mr. Chair, once they're committed, you have a definite treatment plan for MSOP. If we're not committing them, then what are they getting at the DOC level then that they would not be getting?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, MSOP has the advantage of having treatment be its primary design. So everything a client does in a day becomes part about treatment. So the security, while it's a secured facility, and we obviously have security counselors that provide security, they are part of the treatment process. In prison, correctional officers are not part of the treatment process. It's more delineated between those two experiences. It's difficult to create a therapeutic environment in a prison just because of the environment with regard to safety and security. The program in the MSOP DOC site that is located in the prison is licensed under 2965, which is a rule. It's the same rule that is held accountable to the other sex offender programs in prisons. So in some ways, the programming there is closer to DOC because it follows the same licensing. The concentration of treatment, I think, is stronger in the MSOP DOC site because those clients have more issues to deal with because they are the ones that are targeted for civil commitment.
Representative Johnson and then Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the director, I guess, one question I have is what percentage or what kind of number are you talking about in terms of these civil commitments receiving treatment that the treatment works to the extent that they can be a manageable risk in the community? I'm trying to get a feel for how many people can actually be discharged, in your professional opinion.
Director, or either one?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it's very, very difficult for us to quantify that. What we can tell you is that 5 years ago, 6 years ago, about 50% were involved in treatment. Today, that number is up to 80% are now involved in treatment. 5 years ago, we had nobody in community preparation service, which is kind of the last stop before provisional discharge. Today, we have seven in community preparation service. We're all aware of the newspaper article that talks about two that are going to have their petition reviewed by the Supreme Court appeal panel. So this train is just starting to move. How many do we believe? First of all, we never use the word cure. We don't believe we can cure these people. We do believe that there will be some that we can reduce risk to a point where we can responsibly supervise and manage them in the community. We are confident that our reintegration program and process is such that as these people leave the program, if the courts decide somebody is ready, we're prepared to do everything we can to ensure that there is a reasonable transition and that they have a shot, and if they don't, they will be returned. So out of that 600, I can tell you, well, 20% aren't involved in treatment. There are some that get stuck in treatment. There are some that move forward a little bit and then digress. I have also said we have about 125 that are low functioning, that are people that if they weren't sex offenders would probably be living in a 24/7 group home, adult foster care, or something. So that is another piece of our population that we look at a little bit differently, and it's another discussion I think we need to have as we move forward in terms of is there another way to manage that population. Under good supervision, we might be able to manage them a little bit differently. So as Janine said, there are about 4,500 civil commits in America in the 2021 programs. About 10% have been discharged or released, or courts have decided to release them. So it's a small number. We have to remember who we're dealing with here. As we said at the onset with the funnel, we're dealing with 600. When you consider all of the 18, 19,000 registered sex offenders, we have a tough crowd. But the other danger here that I think we all have to get in touch with is this is a program for people who are civilly committed, not criminally committed. And the courts are watching this process very, very closely. And I don't think it was ever the intent that we would create this program and nobody would ever, ever get out. I just think there will be, again, this is my opinion, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge, but I think there will be some kind of legal intervention if something doesn't start to happen in this program. I mean, the notion that we're just going to treat, and nobody is ever going to get to a point where we think we can manage them in the community, I don't think that boat is going to float with the courts. And we do know now that there are judges out there in terms of a public safety issue that are also, in some cases, might be rare, but some there's some reluctance to commit them to this program because the wheels haven't turned. And they may not be committing some people that really do need commitment or some kind of treatment intervention. So that's another danger that we all have to be aware of, too, is if there's no confidence in this program, are people going to be reluctant to commit people, and they're going to remain in the community? One of the weaknesses here that, again, we all need to understand is you're either in or you're out. There's really no middle ground here. And that's, I think, is one of the weaknesses of the Minnesota program. And we have had some conversation about are there some other possibilities or opportunities, and we're happy to discuss some of those as we move forward, too. But trying to quantify, getting back to your question, that would be very, very difficult. But I can tell you that the seven people that are at community preparation service, for the most part, we have some confidence that they have adequately moved through the steps of the program. But anything can happen at any point, too. Now, the one thing that is critical is a good reintegration program. We can't just simply dump them into the community and expect that they're going to make it, nor is that our intent. We have, I think, a very well-defined reintegration plan. If someone is released by the courts, they will go to a halfway house for 2 to 6 months. We will have a reintegration agent assigned to them. They will have daily contact. They will continue outpatient treatment. They'll be on GPS. They will be given urinalysis from time to time, and there will be lots and lots of contact. One of the luxuries that we have that the DOC doesn't have is they're going to drip out of this program. DOC is releasing 6,000 offenders a year. We're going to, you know, our first year might release, the courts might release one or two or three. Wisconsin does about 8 to 15 a year. So these programs are never, they're never going to pour out. So I think that is another advantage that we have. And, you know, back to the, you know, the global question, should we have civil commitment or should we just try to properly sentence everybody and give them long prison sentences? In many of those cases, I would argue that at some point that prison sentence will expire too, and then they will be in the community, and we don't have the hammer over them that either you do treatment or you're going to continue to be confined. We have a large net in Minnesota with respect to our program. We lock up or civilly commit more per capita than any other program. Are there other ways? Should we be looking at adjusting that? Possibly. We also have, by virtue of numbers, we're the third largest program in the United States. As Janine said when we were talking about the funnel, remember now, we're talking about maybe 15% of all sex offenders. 85% of sex offenses, sexual incidents of sexual violence, are probably not reported. So if we have to focus on where this problem begins, I would suggest that we've got to begin to have some dialogue around that as well. This whole notion of prevention, getting people in touch with what sexual violence is, awareness, doing some research around this issue. If we just figure out a way to beat up bad enough on the 15%, the other 85% aren't going to go away. Oh, I use the analogy often of our healthcare system. If we would have spent all of our money on simply hospice care and end-of-life comfort and done nothing around what's the causation of cancer and leukemia and tumors and whatnot, where would we be? And I just think this is a very complex, complicated area, and I think we've got to start to pay some attention to why are we growing so many sex offenders in the state of Minnesota? It's a much larger problem than the 15% that we are dealing with. We've got a handful of slides. Let us blast through them, if you will, and then we're happy to stand for additional questions.
Director, one question here. What's the percentage or number of persons who are civilly committed under other statutes who are never released?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair?
What are the numbers of persons who are civilly committed under other statutes who are never released?
Mr. Chair and members, that would be mentally ill and dangerous, probably some MRs. I don't have that information, but we can probably get that from Department of Human Services. I can tell you that many of those people are also in the system for prolonged periods of time.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen, do you want to ask it now? I'll take one more question, and then, or did you have a follow-up?
I'll wait till after the slides are done.
That's what I was thinking, too. I can wait till I have them finish their slides, and then I'll...
Okay. Sounds good. Go ahead.
So just in moving forward, the mission of St. Peter is twofold. That's our other site. One is what Dennis had spoken about, the alternative program. Those are individuals with compromised executive functioning. They do all of their treatment down in St. Peter, so they do all phases down in St. Peter. And then the other mission of St. Peter is, again, to prepare for reintegration, and those are clients at the later stages of treatment. So here's the final treatment slide. It gives you a snapshot. This may help a little bit about the numbers on the top of each step shows how many clients are in those phases or stages of treatment. So again, folks come up to Moose Lake at admissions. We have about 39 on that admissions unit. 537 are doing primary treatment in either Moose Lake or St. Peter. That would be the first two phases of treatment. And then the third step is what we call the supervised integration program, and that's down in St. Peter. So those are folks who are in phase three of treatment, and that's where they start to prepare for reintegration. And when they're in MSI, they are all put on ankle bracelets, and they progress through privileges, the ability to walk on campus in St. Peter, escorted with staff, the ability to go into town escorted with staff, and then the ability to walk on the St. Peter campus unescorted with staff, all with ankle bracelets, all with monitoring. But it's that preparation for the outside world. These folks have been incarcerated and have been institutionalized with us for decades, and it would be irresponsible to move too quickly through that process. We want to give them, let them take a step, see how they're doing, if they regress, if it's still safe, move on to the next step. In order for them, again, to move from MSI to the step of community preparation services, that's the court placement, that's where SRB and SCAP come into play, and then again, the court's place for provisional discharge and then full discharge.
Mr. Chair and members, Dan Storkanth, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and I'm going to provide you about 8 slides of just high-level background information about the program. As Janine talked about, the first stage of the referral process is the Department of Corrections reviewing cases to determine who is referred or how many people are going to be referred. The numbers that you see in the chart here are the actual numbers each year that they referred. In 2010, the number I just received is 124, so it's up about 10 from the previous year. Notice in 2003 we had an increase of 235. That was a system change basically in response to a tragic case that occurred back in 2003. There was no law changes that occurred at that time. It was a business practice or a change in the system itself. What this does for the program is it really changed our population coming in. If you take a look at the bars on the left, the black bars, that's the population as it actually was. In 2000 there was 149 clients in the program. As of July of 2010, 575, and as the director talked about, in, as of January, we had 605 in the program. On the right side, you're seeing the projections moving forward. This is based on current law, current trends, and current practices. One of the big pieces that is unknown for the program is the practice itself. I know this committee reviews an awful lot of fiscal notes and projections for corrections, and that's really based on the policy that you're bringing forward to them. And I'll give you an example of how that impacts an MSOP more of a longer term. But really, ours is more impacted by the changes in the practice itself. And again, we're about 50 per year growing into the future. What this does for us overall, this is actually the same chart. The numbers in the bars going up is our projections. The black bar at the bottom is our capacity. So you'll see by 2013, will be right about capacity of our program with our current beds and current available space. One of the things that we look at, again, is changes in laws that may come down. If a new law is implemented this year, for example, that new law is going to take some time to take effect. Either the crime has to occur, the system has to respond, but the system actually responds with arrest or review of the case, arrest, going through the court process, and then there's also a conviction. And then there's time that they're actually going to serve under the Department of Corrections already. Our clients serve an average of 8 to 10 years on Department of Corrections in prison before they ever come to our program. So the impact of a law is going to not be felt for several years on the Minnesota sex offender population as we move forward. In 2007, the program made some significant changes to the process. In doing so, we were able to make some adjustments to our staffing patterns and reduced over 200 staff. At the same time, we were growing over 200 in our client population. And as a result, next slide, our budget actually decreased by 13.5% between 2008 fiscal year and 2010. This was really to bring it in line with the current practice of both treatment as well as the security changes that we put in place. As a reduction in the overall population and the increased population occurred, our per diem actually dropped dramatically as well. It went from $387 per day in 2007 to $328 today. One of the things I think that's really important to note is when a new person or a new client comes into our program, the cost of that new client is only $144 a day. It's the incremental cost of bringing somebody on. Therefore, each person we're bringing on, our overall per diem will reduce. And that's how you see the reduction that we occurred here. Looking at other civil commitment programs, we did a quick study or a quick analysis of other states that have programs similar to us, and they've got a per diem ranging from $100 to $500 a day. But just be aware there's no consistent standard like in corrections across states. Nobody can calculate per diems consistently. Looking at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, our operating per diem, this is the dollars that are provided through the general fund, Our operating per day is only $302 per day. But if you add in bonding and interest, which is our statutory or our full per diem, that's how we get up to $328 a day. And on the last slide, we just break down for you the actual cost of the $67.4 million, which is our operating for our $302 per day, and then adding in the other cost as statutorily required.
Okay, could we jump in with a couple of questions here, if we could. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Benson, I appreciate your statements on the complexity of the issue and agree with a lot with what you say. One question I have with respect to if and when some of these civil commits are discharged, is the supervision thereof of those individuals, since they've completed their sentence, they wouldn't be under the supervision of corrections. Who would they be under the supervision of, and how long, and what would that look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, when they're on provisional discharge status, they are still under the jurisdiction of the Department of Human Services. If they are no longer under criminal commitment, their criminal sentence has expired, we would have we call them reintegration specialists, which would be analogous to a corrections agent. We would manage them in the community. Certainly we would be working with the counties. County social workers are certainly invited to be part of that process. But one of the statute changes we made last year was, let's have a seamless system. If somebody does get out, we know them. We've worked with them for, in most cases, many years. Our reintegration specialists will follow them then into the community and manage them in the community.
And just briefly, Mr. Chair, and how long would that supervision occur?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, obviously, as long as they're on provisional discharge status, they would be under some level of supervision. Now, we haven't had one, as you know, for many years, so we're writing the book here as we move forward, but certainly initially there, as I said, there would be daily contact. If they're out successfully for 2-3 years, that might start to diminish a little bit, but we're going to keep an eye on these folks. We know how incredibly sensitive this issue is. I think these are part of our population that the public is genuinely afraid of, and we want to reassure to the extent that is reasonable that we are going to do everything we can to ensure public safety with respect to decisions that the courts have made around provisional discharge. Full discharge, if somebody ever got there, then of course they would no longer be under supervision.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director. I have a twofold question. First is in relationship to cost. I've heard it, the same type of range you mentioned here today, I've heard anywhere from $100 a day in some states all the way up to $500-$600 a day. Do you ever do an analysis why we're where we are versus a state? I heard Florida is like $100 a day for this type of thing. Do you ever do an analysis and a comparison of why their costs are where they're at versus where we're at so that you understand why we're three times higher? We could almost fly them down to Florida and pay to have them put down there, and we'd be cheaper off than keeping them here in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Director, go ahead.
And Representative. When I spent my time in corrections, I chased this butterfly around for 15 years trying to compare apples to apples with respect to per diems. And it is so complicated. There we were dealing with 50 states, of course, and one state would include health care, but there were states that the university hospital provided health care, so that was not part of the per diem. There was another state that provided education and services through the university system, so that was not part of the per diem. So it is very, very difficult to get there. We are in, because we're smaller now, we're dealing with 21 programs, it's 21 with the federal system. it's going to be easier for us to get at that. I would be careful when I hear $100 a day. When you look at our statute and you look at the court test of what is required to keep somebody confined based on what we think they might do in the future, it's more than just three hots and a cot. We are required by statute and by case law to provide treatment for everybody who wants it. That's the real cost driver here between security and clinical. That's 85% of our cost. So we will do the very best we can to get there. The other thing I would say is remember now, Florida has this bad habit of allowing sex offenders to live under a causeway. I don't think we want to go down a road of shortchanging what this release process ought to look like. They are, I don't know the program. I don't know the program director, so I'm not going to make a value judgment on, is it a good one or is it a bad one? I've read the same articles you have about what happens when they're released. And I think this treatment program, like chemical dependency treatment is one thing, but learning to live that sober life, learning to live that life in the community and apply what you've learned in treatment is something very different. We haven't had the opportunity to participate in that until we may get it, we may not, depending on what the court decides to do here. But that's where we're really going to understand, is this a worthwhile expense or isn't it? And I think it's way more complicated than either civil commitment or prison. I can tell you that when you look at, I know that you are contemplating a law change for CrimSex 1, just a fact, that between 2006 and 2009, only 15% of the CrimSex 1s released from prison came to our program. So, I mean, we're, again, casting a wide net to try to gather a few more in, and you aren't going to enhance too many more laws before you're paying way more on the correction side than the civil commitment side. So I think it is a balance. I think a balanced approach, a continuum of opportunities and possibilities is the best approach. But again, to reiterate my earlier statement, I think we've got to swim way further upstream than even corrections. We got to get at some of the, get a better understanding of where is this coming from, what's driving it.
Mr. Chair, Director, just a follow-up question. I happened to run into a longtime employee of one of these that worked at one of these facilities during my campaign, and I had quite a good conversation with her. Her comments were, number one, the treatment doesn't work, in her opinion, and again, this longtime employee of the facility. Number two, they get better health care, they get computers, they have access to softcore pornography, they live better in the facility than many people do outside the facility. And number three, do we have a strong work ethic as part of the treatment? Do they go out and work very hard, difficult work? In other words, let's not make them as comfortable as possible. How about making them a little bit miserable? And I am talking about chain gangs, okay, where they do strong physical work, which is one of the best medicine for deviant behavior, from my observation. And I'm a layperson. Would you respond to those comments, please?
Mr. Chair?
Director, go ahead.
Representative, I don't know what years your constituent worked at the facility, but I can tell you that computers were removed even before I got there in 2008. Porn has not been there for at least that many years, probably longer. We do have a vocational work program that I think is a very real part of treatment, where depending on where they're at in the treatment protocol, they are permitted to work X number of hours. We have to pay them for that time. Again, this is a civilly committed program. This is not a criminal commitment, so we have to be careful what we do and don't do with respect to those conditions of confinement where the courts are going to step in. I believe that for some of these people, your constituent is right. Treatment doesn't work. But I believe for some of these people, treatment does work. It's not one size fits all. It's individualized treatment. That's another stark difference between this program and the DOC program, is it's very individualized. We have people with 130 IQ, and we have others with a 65 IQ. We have 89-year-old men, and we have 21-year-old kids. We have folks that have lots of mental health issues and others that are very sophisticated. So it is a complex population to try to develop a standard treatment protocol. We simply can't. So if it were that easy, my job and my life would be a whole lot easier now. But certainly we keep them busy. But they get to choose whether or not they want to participate in treatment, because again, it is a civilly committed program. We can't put a gun to their head. We can't force them to get involved in treatment. Obviously, there are privileges that come along with being involved in treatment. But again, case law is being written about how we need to manage this population, and we have to pay attention to that.
Just one follow-up, quick follow-up question.
Representative Gruenigan,
Chair. You know, just are any states applying castration to this group of offenders?
Mr. Chair, Representative, chemical castration is the use of antiandrogens. So someone either has a patch or they get injections to decrease their level of testosterone in the hopes of taking out the issue of having an erection, to be honest. Chemical castration has been put on conditions of probation in some states with some sex offenders, so that you'll be released back in the community under this condition that you have to go to the psychiatrist to get antiandrogens. People commit sex offenses for a lot of different reasons, and high testosterone level is rarely part of the issue in a sex offending behavior. So you'd have difficulty prescribing that to the vast majority of sex offenders because it wouldn't meet their condition and the issue of what you're trying to treat.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. I would respectfully disagree. It sure worked well on the farm, I'll tell you that. Okay. Anyway, thank
you. We've got six people on the list here, so if we could keep the questions and answers a little short. Representative Woodard is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Benson. I understand that this can't be a fun job, so I appreciate the fact that somebody has to do it, and I appreciate you stepping up the plate to do that. And I will honor the chairman's request here and keep my question short. There's lots of questions. We're not going to solve this issue today in this hearing. But you mentioned that 15% of level one sex offenders from DOC actually go to MSOP. My understanding was that these are the worst of the worst that we have civilly committed. Why is it, do you think, that only 15% of our worst of the worst out of DOC are actually going to MSOP? Or if I misunderstood your response, that's fine too.
Director?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dan, jump in if you want here. I can tell you that, and Janine will, I think, support this as well, that there is such a range of sexual violence in the state that comes before these, first of all, the Department of Corrections make the referral to the county attorney. County attorney then has to reconcile that behavior with the statute. Do they meet the letter of sexually dangerous person or sexual psychopathic personality? And then obviously the judge ultimately makes that final determination. And it's not always driven by our criminal sexual conduct code. I mean, there are, we have crimsex 2s, we have crimsex 3s, we have a couple of younger adults who have never been convicted of an adult sex offense. So it depends, too, on the pattern of behavior, not necessarily was this a power rapist. But if you have a pedophile who continues to abuse children time after time after time, it becomes that pattern of sexual acting out that really becomes the hinge pin in terms of who ends up there. So again, getting back to if we're just harder on crimsex ones, are we going to start to slow the growth? Well, you will a little bit. But and again, the numbers that we gave were, it was a three-year period from 2006 to 2009.
Yeah, and I do want to just mention that sentencing guidelines is based on two things. It's the crime that's there, CSC 1 through 4, as well as the priors. And so it's really a cut and dry, you go on the grid, here's where it is. The civil commitment isn't looking at that grid. It's looking at all the offenses that this individual's had in the past, as well as Dennis talks about the pattern of sexual behavior around that. Just sentencing guidelines and us did a study last year, and we found that of 486 clients in our program, they went back to see what their original charge was, and 42% had a first degree on their record at some point. So not even half had a first degree, but realize some of our clients weren't actually sentenced previous to sentencing guidelines, which was done in 1980. So there's also a history and a long-term impact of this as well. But I think it's real important that it is looking at something completely different than what guidelines is looking at. It's really the patterns.
So one quick...
I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, just one more piece. When I mentioned earlier about sex offender being a legal term, and as a treatment program, the psychological makeup does not always match what somebody got caught for. And so if you're using the bar of CSC-1, that may not necessarily draw correlation to dangerousness and to depth of pattern of psychopathy.
So one quick follow-up, and thank you for that explanation. I think that may mean we have a real disconnect in our criminal code versus what you think are our worst sex offenders or the ones that are most likely to be risk to the public safety. So that may be something that we really need to take a strong look at because those numbers are a little scary. The other scary number, of course, is the amount of money we have to spend in the years going out to 2020 and the amount of people we'll have civilly committed. First of all, civil commitment is a scary thing. You know, in and of itself, we're taking away somebody's personal liberty, and we ought to have a good reason for that. I think sex offense is a good reason for that. But you mentioned that you've got the joint commitment or the dual commitment, where you've got folks at DOC in Moose Lake as well as at your not necessarily at your facility, but you're helping treat. Do you know what the per diem is on that? Is that a significant difference between being in the full treatment program?
Oh, Director. Either?
Mr. Chair and Representative, if they are in corrections, if they're, what generally happens is they come to us and they've got some time hanging, the county decides to civilly commit them, they get civilly committed, and then by virtue of refusing to participate in treatment, we can violate the conditions of their placement in our program, we send them back to corrections. When they're in corrections, they fall under that $85, $89 a day per diem. And that tool has been very, very helpful to us because if we've got people who are not interested in treatment, we get them back to corrections, we get them off of our per diem into that cheaper per diem, and there are others in our program that are much more likely to participate in treatment if these guys who have a different agenda are no longer there. So when they're with us, it really boils down to that $300 a day. When they're with corrections, I think it's up around $88, $89 a day.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director, I've got a series of questions here before I get onto the list here. First of all, administrative question, the sex offenders at St. Peter, do they have TPT or public education television down there? Because some of them were watching our last committee hearing on TV. Or was it a recast of a news show? You know,
Mr. Chair and members, most of our clients do have a TV set, so they could be watching a rerun, they could be watching it live. That's not unusual. It happens in the prison system, too.
They weren't too excited about my bill to increase the limit on sex offenders. I got some rather, tough questions here for you. Is The article in the newspaper, what I've taken directly from my constituents, the battle I'm up against is people saying, goodness gracious, if this is the best of the worst, where in the world are we? In other words, these guys are serial rapists, torture, curling irons, all sorts of scary things, torture. But yet we're considering releasing them because they're the most likely, I don't know, to most unlikely to reoffend. So what in the world is the profile on the rest of the people that we aren't considering, and what possible hope if we're releasing serial rapists and torture suspects? So it's a kind of a tough one for you, but it's a question directly from, and immediately the email I got is, and Mrs. Hebert, you probably know from my previous testimony, I'm not a big fan of treatment. I'm kind of a lock 'em up person, but I also realize we have to pay for it, and it's frustration. You can't just lock everybody up forever. So what do you think of the premise of putting money into education earlier on? And if that doesn't work and they snap, then life without parole or just an, I mean, what changing the statutes to accomplish the same thing as a murder sentence? Because the only thing between difference between a murder and a torturous rape is that one is dead and one has to live with it. So what do you think of more money in education, but if it doesn't work, then just sealing it off?
Mr. Chair, my expertise isn't in sentencing, so I'll leave that to you. I can go back to the comments from your constituent with regard to, and I think what they're referring to is some of the histories of the clients. Particularly the ones that were in the article are those who are being considered for provisional discharge, and those would be the men who are furthest along in the process. When you think about recidivism and the rates of recidivism or the likeliness that someone will reoffend, there's two categories with sex offenders that we take a look at in research supports, and those are static factors and dynamic factors. And static factors will not change. So a client coming in the door, and there's actuarial tools that measure static factors. So that would be whether or not you've offended against a male. Male victims tend to have a higher, if you had just male victims, higher recidivism rate. So that fact isn't going to change, whether you are an untreated sex offender in process of treatment or leaving treatment program. What you've done in the past and what got you there is a static factor. The dynamic factors are what we focus on in treatment, which is something that can change. And so that I can't defend, and I would certainly not excuse the behaviors of our clients at MSOP. The reality is that those facts aren't going to change, and that what we target in treatment is why they did what they did, how they did what they did, what precursors are present before they do what they did, and that's what we focus on in treatment. So I'll defer to Mr. Benson to have the conversation about sentencing. I can only offer what we look at with regard to recidivism, and those are the actuarial tools and then the dynamic risk factors.
And Mr. Benson, Director Benson, I wasn't trying to make light of the subject, but it's a real question. Right now, politically, face it, politicians can't be too hard on sex offenders. I mean, that's just a basic fact. But we also, with the hard way we approach it, we know that we have to pay for it. And so we're up against the wall here because our citizens are saying, are you kidding? You're going to release these two guys? We're in the paper on us? And what do the rest look like versus... do we really want to pay for it? It's
Mr. Chair and members, your member, I don't envy your job either. I think that this is a very, very difficult subject to have a rational conversation about. I do think that it's important that we try to demonstrate sound thinking and good leadership when we talk about something as explosive as this, and I applaud your efforts in that regard. I think Minnesota has historically done, I think, a nice job of trying to look at what is the best balance here. In terms of treatment, there are many states that don't have inpatient treatment for sex offenders. We get a little hung up, though, when we talk about our population. I keep going back to the funnel. But remember, there are many sex offenders who never reoffend, so we can't paint them all with a broad brush either. Some of the lower level offenders come in, do their time, get out, and we never hear from them again. We have a very complex crowd. The 600 that we're dealing with really are a little bit different. And I think what I would advocate for, again, is balance in the system. I don't think Minnesota, with 5 million people, should have a, quite frankly, a program that civilly commits 605 people compared to California, who has, what, 30 million people, who have, I think, maybe 700 civil commits. So I think there, the net might be a bit wide. Could more of those end up in prison, be treated there, and properly released? Probably. Are there other community-based interventions that we could look at? I think so. So I think it really is a mixed bag. Again, I don't think it's as simple as one or the other. I think it has to be a blend. I do say, again, underscore the notion that I think this program has to start working, or the concept is in trouble from a legal perspective. And then I think we have a whole another kind of public safety mess, potentially. So we have to manage that. Again, we don't decide when they go out. You don't decide. That is a court decision. Courts, again, will look at the documents that treatment providers provide, and they will make an informed decision about whether or not this person can be managed in the community. And there will probably be a handful of those if this program survives going forward. If we decided to sentence everybody tomorrow, we still have 600 people that are going to be with us for 30, 40, 50 years. Or what do we do with them? Do we somehow uncivilly commit them? I don't know. I don't know that that's a good option either. Now, there are obviously 30 states that do it differently. There are 30 states that don't have a civil commitment program. What they do, I'm not sure. I think it's probably all over the map. We also know that there's a state or two that manage civil commitments in the community, which is another approach that I think it's Texas uses. So when we talk about who these people are, though, I can tell you that these really are the people that probably need to be civilly committed. They have an average of, I think it's 16 victims if we average them out. They aren't one-time offenders. They are people who have long histories, very complex profiles, and that's who comes to the program. So obviously, when the courts decide it's time to release somebody, that's what it's going to read like when it's time to release them. We don't have a lot of lightweight offenders in our program. So that is that's going to make it difficult for all of us to try to explain that to the public. But I grew up in prison, and I had my doubts about the efficacy of treatment of these folks. But I can tell you that when I visit Moose Lake, where people start their treatment experience, they're a very different individual than they are 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 20 years later when they get down community preparation service, and we're prepared to present a different kind of profile to the court in terms of should they get a shot at community placement or not. So I think for some of them, we can change behaviors, reduce risks. We verify that with polygraph, plethysmograph, and therapists that have made it their life's work to try to understand these people. It's a unique business, and we have tools today and technology today that we didn't have even 10 years ago in terms of trying to understand risk factors and trying to manage them properly in the community. So I think that the right approach is to have all the options on the table and to look at developing a continuum of possibilities as opposed to just civil commitment or just prison sentences. I think there's a whole lot more in the middle, but again, I can't emphasize enough the need to try to get at this issue at a different intersection in the process.
One more question. I'll turn it over to the four members here. If trying to figure out the right way to phrase this. Is that I'm going to think about that a second before I ask that and go to Representative McDonald. Go ahead.
Oh, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, thanks again. I've been exposed to your testimony and the work that you do. Now, this is the third time I also sit on the Health and Human Services, so I do want to say I am grateful for the work you do. It's certainly not easy. And I hesitate to ask this question because I have a number of them, which many of us do, but I've heard you say that we can't cure these people. You believe that we can't cure these people. And that I've also heard you say that some can be treated successfully, and then I've heard that they can't be treated. So I have to say ask this question. Of the 10,000 or so sex offenders that we have, you're treating 600 of them, and I'll call them offenders, not clients, you'll recognize, Mrs. Hebert. Why is the law, or do you believe the law should be changed that the 20% that don't participate when they're civilly committed should participate in the treatment? As you said in the document of this piece, that 80% are treated, 20% are not, and they can refuse that by law. I think if we can stop one offender, perpetrator, from making an offense if he's released and save the life or save the victim by that 20% treating them, then we've done a good job. You've done a good job. Do you think the law should be changed to insist that all those who are committed should be treated, whether it works or not? Should they be treated and not have the right to say, oh, I don't want to be treated, I'm fine?
Director?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I'll let Janine respond to that too. But from my perspective, I think, again, we might have trouble with the constitutionality of that law change. I'm not a lawyer, but they are civilly committed. We don't have the hammer that we do in a criminal case to require that they participate or there will be consequences. When we throw around the word cure or reduce risk, the word we like is reduce risk. And again, I'm an asthmatic, and I'm probably never going to be cured, but I can manage my asthma. There are things that I can do to manage it. And I think sex offenders are not much different. I remember when I took this job, Janine was talking to me one day about, imagine waking up every morning and the only thing you can think about, the only thing that's on your mind is grooming some little kid for sex. And you're obsessed with that day after day after day after day. And it kind of drove the point home that, you know, I don't think I have anybody in my program who wanted to be a sex offender when they were 4 years old. I just don't think that happens. I think they, at some point in their life, probably have the same hopes and dreams as young children that we all had. Something went very wrong. As I keep saying, this is a complex, complex issue. I think we need to start to get at some of that. That's where we can make progress. What does happen when they're 3, 4, 5 years old that turns them into these folks that we are so incredibly fearful of as they grow into adults? The other point that we don't use the word cure. What I will underscore, though, is we do use the word reduce risk. And I think that's key here. We're never going to put somebody into the community and say they're cured. They're not. They're, again, no different than the asthmatic. Or I always hesitate to use the analogy of those that suffer from chemical dependency issues, but they take it one day at a time, too. Our sex offenders will as well. They will understand what those triggers are, and hopefully we can help them manage that as they move into the community. So the other thing I would say about those that don't participate, we really don't want people in our treatment groups that don't want to be there. They're too disruptive for the others. So what we try to do, the non-treatment participants, they don't just sit and play Monopoly all day. We still have classes. We try to treatment-ready classes. We try to encourage them to continue to pursue some level of treatment. And, you know, I know that we have people that are engaged in treatment that fully know they'll probably never be released, but they're trying anyway. They're going to try to carve out some kind of life, whether it's a secure environment or not. I will also tell you that I've had in the 3 years that I've been in this program, and remember, most of these people came from corrections. So many of them and I go back a long ways from my years in corrections. But I've had clients say, I should never be released. You should never let me out. I'm in the right place. And that tells me, too, that something went very, very wrong during their childhood upbringing, whatever it was. It's a very complex issue. And the last point I would make is we hear so often that most sex offenders were also abused as children. And for sex offenders, taking Janine's thunder here, as a group, that is a myth. It's not true. But in our group, it's almost 100% true that our folks were sexually abused as kids. So, and they're the most difficult, the most entrenched sex offenders of the pool that we're aware of. So we do know that there is a connection between that childhood abuse and what they might become in the future. And again, getting back to prevention, doing some research around that, education and awareness, I think that's a great place to start.
Representative, you done?
No, just thank you for that explanation and appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have two questions. The first one basis is a lot of advocates for victims think we should be stressing the prevention, as you brought up earlier, 85% or more are unreported, and I think even higher percentage are of the acts are caused by somebody that has never been prosecuted before. But as of at least I think around a year and a half or 2 years ago, Minnesota wasn't even putting a dime into any kind of prevention. I know in the health department, you got, you got a federal grant for, I think Patty Wetterling's running it out of the health department. And so two questions. Has the state ever put in any money into prevention? And second of all, how soon does the federal grant run out?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, the program that you're speaking is from the Department of Health, which is different from the Department of Human Services, which is what our umbrella is. But you're accurate. It's my understanding that is Patty Wetterling's position over under Department of Health, who could speak to that with regard to the federal grant and the time on that. Having worked with sex offenders for many years in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota has a very rich history of hardworking folk in the area of victim advocacy as well as sexual abuse prevention. There are a lot of very hardworking programs around from nonprofits, from inside the state agencies. MSOP has one full-time position that we've recently created for prevention. We're very invested in that. I agree with Dennis when he says our clients didn't decide to grow up to be sex offenders. I think it's our obligation professionally to take a look at who did make it through that funnel and who is in civil commitment. What can we learn from this group so we can decrease additioning, adding to that population down the road? And the position that we have at MSOP is designed to assist in connecting the dots of all of the interventions that are being made in the area of prevention. I think sometimes there are pockets that don't have the visibility. MSOP definitely has the visibility, for better or for worse, because of the population that we treat.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one more question.
There, Mallory?
One of the legislators referred to we should put them under, make it tough on them to be there. Most of the studies I've read show that the more tough you or more stress you put on the life, the more they tend to recidivate or something like that. Is that are those studies correct or wrong? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative, in general, that's accurate. It's a tricky line to walk. I'm not an advocate for sex offenders. I don't excuse sex offenders, and I have read far more cases of tragedy in my career than most. So when I talk about treatment, I come to it with that understanding of how to get at these individuals and provide them an opportunity to change. I think that it would be helpful to have work crews and to force people to do treatment. But if anyone in our lives was forced to become sober when they didn't want to, or forced to take depression medication when they didn't want to, we know that a stick doesn't always help. So the idea of having more carrots than sticks, even with the most heinous population that exists, as sex offenders, is really the approach that needs to happen. In engaging with these individuals and establishing trust and encouraging them to take a look at some of the most shameful, destructive acts that they've done and why they've done it is challenging work for both the clinician and for the client, which is why we call them clients. In using the term offender, it's another reminder of their shame, and that would be another barrier to engaging in them in the change process. So I don't use that term because I think I'm soft on sex offenders or to be nice to these individuals. It's truly used methodically to engage them in a process of change. I can't force them to change. I can't force them to not act out once they're released. So the best we can do, as with any human being, is to establish a working relationship that when they feel they're at risk, that they have a place to go. With regard to the impact of stress on an individual, it's a tricky balance between having things like web pages where you put sex offenders' names out or community notifications, which in many cases now research is indicating that those are false sense of security, when in fact they really don't decrease recidivism. And they actually decrease reporting, because when you think of the difference, when you think of the perpetrator is known to the victim, victims are unlikely to report crimes when they see what happens to sex offenders out in the world, and they don't want that to happen to their coach or their priest or to dad or to their uncle. And that decreases reporting, which is the exact opposite of what we're trying to get to. So it's about balancing our inherent reaction to the ugliness of sex offending, which I think we all can agree on, but having the balance to create environments where victims will report, as well as environments where offenders will choose to change.
And Representative Kelly, followed by Representative Kiefer, and then we're at the end of our list right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Benson, you mentioned a couple times the issue of the constitutionality of the program. And I guess it's my understanding we're obligated to provide a treatment to these individuals. We can't control whether that individual will be able to go through the treatment and be successful. So just an observation, but I would say that we're meeting our constitutional obligation that way. But my question and a new study that I had read, I apologize, I'll have to come up with the origin, but the report on recidivism and the correlation between going through a treatment program and the recidivism rate apparently is only a few percentage points. And I was wondering, maybe Ms. Haber can help me out. We're spending a lot of dollars on managing risk. And so if we're getting very little reward in that regards, would you be in favor of indeterminate sentencing on the criminal side or increased sentencing?
Director, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're accurate with regard to the impact of treatment effect on recidivism. There's enough studies out there now to support that treatment does decrease recidivism. The problem with this population is that there's a very low base rate of recidivism in general with sex offenders compared to other types of offenders. And again, that legal term sex offender makes it a hodgepodge of a group. But if you think that as a group, sex offenders recidivate between 5 and 15% rate on average, that's a very low rate to impact. That said, with respect to what Representative said earlier, if you have one sex offender who doesn't hurt another human being, how much do we want to spend on that one sex offense that didn't happen? So that's how it is difficult to capture the impact of the percentage of between treated and untreated, you'll see 5% recidivism rate to 13% recidivism rate for non-treated sex offenders. When some people might look at that and say that's not very significant, and others who have been victimized would say that's excellent. So it is tricky, but it is because it's a low base rate with sex offenders. And I'll let Mr. Storkamp talk about indeterminate sentencing.
Representative Kiefer, or did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess the report I was looking at was more along the lines of 3%, difference between 3%. Would that have been accurate?
Yep, I think you're, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you're referring to the Department of Corrections report, and that is accurate. There are other studies out there. When you look at recidivism studies, it's difficult to do matched studies, to take the exact same type of offender and to have a treated group and a non-treated group, which is what makes some flaws in recidivism studies. But the study you're talking about from the DOC is a very good study, and it took a look at folks who completed sex offender treatment programs in prison.
Thank you.
Were you going to talk about
indeterminate?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and Representative, the only caution I would throw out around indeterminate sentencing would be how, if that's the route we go, I think it has to be separated from the Department of Corrections and the political process. It has to be an independent board, or we have one high-profile event, and then, of course, the gates closed again. So I just think that there might be some value in taking a look at that as an option, but I think it's important that it's structured properly.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Mr. Storkamp, you said earlier that 42% don't have any priors. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, actually, the population we're talking about, 42% have a CrimSex 1 on their record.
Okay. So, and then do you have access, I'm assuming you do, to their juvenile, if there's a juvenile record? Because I think you're doing a holistic approach and treating each case. Is that correct?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, with regard to juvenile offense histories, they may or may not have access to that, to go digging for that. Some juvenile cases are closed. With regard to sentencing, I think that the convictions are considered. As far as treatment goes, we take a really hard look at what happened in their juvenile life, sociologically that way. Mm-hmm. But of course, and perhaps for good reason, juvenile offenses are often diverted because of their age or because of having other programs to go into. So just because they were or weren't convicted doesn't necessarily mean that they did or didn't engage in problematic behavior.
Okay, and then just one quick follow-up. You know, so I'm just trying to see if there's any kind of pattern that we could do prevention sooner in a person's life. And so I wonder, from your opinion, a stiffer penalty than a slap on the hand when you see bad behavior in the juveniles, would that help in the long run, do you think?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I don't know that a stronger slap is what is effective with teenagers. perhaps different interventions, and perhaps identifying the difference between abusive sexual behavior and problematic sexual behavior in younger children. I think that the social work system is what is often through families that comes up through, and they don't always have the forensic lenses that's necessary to interpret that behavior, to really see that really is the continuum of our client's behavior rather than just as perhaps family issues. So I do think, again, it's a reflection, it's a good observation, and it's another reflection of how sex offender issues are comprehensive and not just about who they are by the time they're adults.
Thanks. Representative Grunhagen, followed by Representative Leidiger.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Director, what has been the result, and I don't, you know, of people you have released from this program? Have they reoffended within a certain period of time? Let's just say the last two or three that you have been released. What has been the result of that release?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have not released anybody successfully since the law was written in 93, 94. There was one provisional discharge. It lasted a few months, and he was returned because of a technical violation, and he later passed away in the program. So we have not released anybody, and that, of course, is why we're having a fair amount of conversation about these two potential reviews that are coming up in the next few months.
And Representative Leiterger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Benson, I was focusing on the slide on page 10, the one that talks about the projected growth of bed space needs in the future. And that slide shows, shows that the numbers increase. Is this a managed growth slide, or how are you determining, this kind of growth? And I actually want to kind of couch this question in the area of prevention, and also trying to understand this slide in in the context of our own population growth. And I'm just want to hear from you about how is that put together. Tell me a little bit about it, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative and members, the projections, again, really are based on current laws, current trends, and current practices. So it is a snapshot as of today. If this group makes a decision to move on a different law, for example, that would be something that would affect this direction. So this really is just a point in time that says, if everything continues as it is today, here's where we're going. And when you talk about prevention, that's not factored in at this point, but as you talk about more prevention efforts, those are things that would have to be discussed. If you talk about intermittent sentencing, those would have to be discussed. Or if there is a change from the courts on the number of people that are coming into our process, that would then be done. Projections are done annually, because on an annual basis, you do have enough changes in that process or in the different areas, laws, trends, and practices, that you account for those differences projecting forward. But again, this is just a point in time. Looking forward, we've actually been pretty close with projections the last couple of years. Again, looking at that components.
Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Benson, let's kind of go down that path with these two individuals we're talking about. If the courts do release these individuals, what is the plan specifically there? You outlined a basic plan, but are they released to their communities? Are they released to specific counties? I would assume with the department's resources, you need to be very careful on how we supervise. So could you maybe outline that, please?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll speak generally about what reintegration is going to look like without referring to either of the two cases. What we believe it ought to look like is, again, the first stop would be placement in a halfway house for 2 to 6 months, depending on the individual, depending on his unique needs. But I think these people have been locked up a long time. Most of them have been locked up for at least a decade or two. And that first breath of fresh air is going to be a new experience for them. So getting them into a community that's relatively structured and halfway houses that we're talking to are, and they're used to structure, they would be placed there. They would be on a tight daily schedule. Again, our reintegration specialist would meet with them every day. They may drive them to and from job interviews, looking for supportive housing. We may do some outpatient treatment, might occur at the halfway house, or it might occur at a community-based treatment facility. We would also take some trips away from the halfway house, whether it be to a church, to a social event, to a shopping mall. To begin with, somewhat, it would be supervised. They will have GPS monitoring during that period of time. There may be polygraphs that occur from time to time, make sure that what they're telling us is accurate. And then as they get closer to that six-month period, and that isn't hard and fast either. If somebody isn't doing well, we hope to come to the legislature this year with a very small package that would allow us to move somebody from provisional discharge back into community preparation service for up to 60 days if they need some additional support, if they have a mother who passes away or some kind of traumatic event and they need to move back. We're going to ask for some things that will help us manage them more completely and safely in the community, and that's going to be part of our policy package. So after the halfway house, then it's going to be supportive housing. We're not going to let these people end up in a saturated area. There's concern about that with the sex offenders who are saturating various areas of the metro area. We think we need to continue to keep an eye on them, probably not every day, but certainly continue to monitor them, continue with the outpatient treatment. They might be involved in some kind of outpatient support groups. If they're employable, helping them with the employment piece, and then ultimately getting their own housing. But every case is going to be a little bit different. That reintegration piece is going to vary from case to case. We believe that ultimately they will go to the community or county of best plan, not necessarily county of commitment, because in most cases that happened 20, 30, maybe 40 years ago. May not have a mom or a dad in that community anymore, or any family. Victim might be there. Certainly we do have victim notification every step of the way here, so we're engaged with victims who want to be involved in that part of the process as well. But suffice it to say, they're going to be on a very short leash. Again, if the courts make this decision that it's time to provisionally discharge somebody. And again, as I mentioned at the onset, we have the unique advantage here of caseloads of one, two, or three compared to our friends in the Department of Corrections who are struggling with those high, high caseloads. So we have a unique opportunity here, I think, to do reintegration into the community in a way that is a model and does ensure public safety.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to Representative Leidiger's question and Mr. Storkamp's response. Director Storkamp, just clarify for me, I think when we're talking about growth projections that we were referring to here, that some of the factors involved in that are pretty clearly well defined, like it's based on a current present population that would be eligible for commitment, and we know what that population is. So that's probably the main factor that we're looking at here in growth. The other things that may or may not occur, in my understanding, wouldn't have any immediate effect on the growth projections unless there was a major change in the number of commitments that were made by the courts or recommended by corrections or the county attorneys, others that are involved in the process. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, that is correct. Everything's really based on the number of cases that have come in. Corrections really have three components. It's a really easy process with a lot of intricacies behind it. Those coming in a given year, those that are currently here, and those being released. In corrections, we've got to deal with 6,000 releases. In our program, we don't have that many releases that we're talking about at this time. We're projecting a few into the future. The population that's here that's going to get out, again, that's pretty standard. We've got the majority, 605 as of January 1, that will be getting some components. But it's really how many additional people will be coming in is really driving our projections right now.
Thank you. Okay, looks like we're to the end. We haven't done the minutes from February 3rd. Would somebody make
a motion? So moved, Mr. Chair.
Who was that? Representative Hilty. My hearing is bad. Any additions or corrections? Without that, make a motion to approve the minutes February 3rd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. I sure appreciate it, and we'll look forward to working with you. And if you've got that policy package, you better get to me soon. Deadlines are approaching.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And meeting adjourned.